Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
Now, this is possibly the strangest microbiome study yet, and it's about coffee. I first had this particular kind of coffee in Vietnam. My last trip to Bali, I was taking a walk on the outskirts of Ubud, one of the famous towns of Bali, and I found this little specialty cafe buried away in the rice fields where there were civets and large collections of civet poop. But this wasn't ordinary poop. This was coffee beans in turd form, and it makes a type of coffee that has become, this is Kopi Luwak, and it does come from Indonesia. And it's the flavor of this coffee has been described as nutty, chocolatey, earthy, and it sells for more than 100 times the price of regular brews, Kopi Bali being very cheap in Bali, not this stuff. A team of scientists decided to study what was behind that flavor, and they now say that the digested beans contained high levels of two compounds, commonly used as flavoring agents in dairy product. Now, civet coffee I first had, as I said, in Vietnam. It's produced all over Asia, and the palm civets eat the fruits or cherries of the coffee shrubs. And the seeds inside, which we call beans, can be picked up from their poop. These beans are then roasted, and they make a coffee with a unique flavor. In the United States, these beans cost more than $1,300 per kilogram. And in this country, it's about $75 per cup. I was in a shop in Bali, and asked my Balinese friend if I should buy some to bring home, and he said, oh no, don't buy that. That's counterfeit, not the real thing. But what's going on, really? So if you look at, there was a study done in 2004 that found that civet processed beans were pitted and brittle from having been dipped in hydrochloric acid and digestive juices. And a 2019 paper found that the roasted civet beans were lower in protein and higher than fat. And a paper published late in last year in the journal Scientific Reports compared unroasted coffee beans harvested from the civet cat samples to those picked straight from the plant to see what the digestive systems did to the beans. They used gas chromatography, spectrometry, and they didn't find much difference except higher levels of caprylic and capric acids. These fatty acids are known for their goat-like flavor in dairy products. Aha! The difference is probably caused by digestion and fermentation in the civet guts, and they identified the bacteria. It's called Gluconobacter, and its enzymes play a key part in this conversion. Now, of course, coffee flavor is incredibly complex, and the team notes that the wild civets selectively eat the biggest and ripest coffee cherries. So they're not just picking off all those coffee beans the way you do when you're making commercial coffee. So we'll see what happens with further research, but if you get a chance to go to Southeast Asia, definitely spring for a cup. It's probably no more than the cup of fancy cafe latte coffee would cost you here, and it'll be the experience. You can always say that you've had this, and maybe you'll really like it. So, a quick story about Maria Brañas Moreras. She died last year. She was the oldest living person ever documented when she died last year at 117 years old. She was living in the Catalonia region of Spain. Yes, Mediterranean diet again. And she was pretty active. She read books. She spent time with her family. And on several encounters, the researcher Manuel Estelar went to her and did samples of blood, saliva, urine, and stool to look into her microbiome and her other things. Most of you are probably familiar with a book called The Blue Zone. Actually, a lot of the work in the Blue Zone book has been kind of debunked as being, let's say, insufficiently scientific. For example, when pensions started right after World War II, it became very advantageous for people to, there'd been bombing, the birth certificates were destroyed. They just claimed to be older than they were, and now they're really old. And so now they're in their 90s, but they're really not in their 90s. So some of that may just have been, some of those blue zones may have been a little spurious. But this Sicily being one that's particularly suspect. But one of the main insights from Estelar's work is actually that it's possible to distinguish molecular changes in the body because of aging from those that occur because of poor health. And we've heard about methylation and the body clock and your organ age, and there's lots of companies out there on the internet that are happy to sell you a snapshot of the age of your various organs based on methylation patterns. Branya's telomeres, which are those stretches of repeating DNA that are on the ends of chromosomes, they were exceptionally short. Now, telomeres naturally shorten with age, and unusually short telomeres have been associated with age-related diseases, but Branya's didn't have any of those diseases. So having short telomeres doesn't necessarily mean disease. It can also mean just being like over 100. But what Branius did have was similar variants that we've also seen in long-lived dogs, worms, and flies. And that's lots of anti-inflammatory settings in her system. She also had a decent lipid panel. And at 113, she survived COVID-19, what she didn't get was too much inflammation. COVID-19 causes inflammation by cutting the brake lines on one of our major anti-inflammatory systems. Now, it grows back in most of us, maybe in some of the long COVID people, not so much. Another variation, and this is one we can all do something about, was that Moreira had very high levels of bifidobacterium. This is a type of beneficial probiotic, and this was probably boosted by her diet. She actually ate 3 servings of yogurt a day, and I remember, oh gosh, this must be Life magazine was out, so it has to be 70s at the latest, and there was the thing about people who were living in Siberia who ate a lot of yogurt and were very old. Of course, we're not sure about their birth certificates, but they sure did look old, and they claimed that they ate yogurt every day. Yogurt, of course, does contribute to a healthy microbiome, so it's probably a reasonably good idea to have some of that and maybe a little sauerkraut or sauerkraut juice every day. Okay, before our first little pause, I saw a lady today crossing the street with a baby carriage, and there was a fairly large baby in there, probably maybe 16 months, something like that. And I'm judging by what I saw, which were 2 beautifully pink sunburned legs. And I found myself thinking, people have gotten worried about putting sunscreen on their children. And I had this article that came from the Washington Post, and it was about a critique. It's an editorial. It was a critique of the Environmental Working Group for their sunscreen guide that comes out every year because it ignites fears surrounding sunscreen safety. And the problem with that concern is that these are theoretical concerns, and you've got to weigh the risk and benefit of too much sun. We know it causes skin cancer, and we don't have solid evidence that sunscreens are worse. In fact, we have pretty solid evidence that sunscreens are better. So particularly if you're 113, you probably don't have to worry about sunscreen because you're not going to live long enough to get melanoma. But if you're 18 months and you get a bad sunscreen, the clock starts ticking and you could get a melanoma as early as your late teens. Only a minority of U.S. adults report consistent sunscreen. And another criticism they have is, oh, well, you know, we're telling people to put so much, you know, it's SPF 100, the sort of arms race of SPF. And that's true. That's marketing. If you apply sunscreen well, then you probably only need like an SPF 8, which I doubt you could even find anymore. But if you're sloppy, then the hope is that you will at least smear a small amount of that super strong stuff and catch the area. And how do you know you're sloppy? Well, if you're out in the sun for 6 hours wearing sunscreen and you come home with stripes, you got to pick up your game there on the application. So I do think we need to modernize regulations, although I'm not sure we're going in that direction. But the dermatologists essentially want to say that we can detect. Science has gotten a little bit too good. So showing that sunscreen ingredients are absorbing into someone's blood doesn't prove that they're going to be causing any problems. And the thresholds are at very, very low. So probably this is something that the body's detox can deal with a lot better than the skin's detox can deal with a substantial sunburn. So don't get too creeped out by the EWG on sunscreen. And remember, sunburn is much worse for your health. I simply want to say that about 18 months ago, no, not even that long, but maybe 14 months ago, I was at the annual International Conference for Functional Medicine, and peptides were seriously, seriously big. And everybody wanted to hear more about them and their miraculous properties. And, well, it was kind of a little bit of a feeding frenzy there at the sponsored dinners, so I didn't go. And I went and had healthy food instead. But we're going to talk a little bit about what's currently going on with peptides, because the FDA is in the process of approving them. And I'm sure like many people are like I, back 13 months ago, was like, peptides as a therapeutic agent? Tell me more. So what are peptides? Peptides are chains of amino acids that can perform a range of bodily functions. Insulin is a peptide, technically. Peptides are short proteins or fragments of proteins. And one of the, like, for example, one of the GLP-1 drugs, like semaglutide, are technically peptides. These have gone through, you know, very strict studies and critical review and peer review and publication and replication and all of the things that allow them to be approved by the FDA. But what is on the table right now is largely promoted by RFK Jr. and his belief that peptides are wonderful. And he's, among other things, he's coming out of bodybuilder culture to a certain extent. And bodybuilder culture are all about hacking their body. Self-hacking is one of the terms they use. And so they are fine with using steroid hormones and compounds that maybe interfere with the breakdown of steroid hormones and high doses of certain proteins and now, of course, also they work really hard on themselves. They do these terribly hard workouts and to try to build more muscle. They want to juice the building muscle process. So there's peptides for that, and they want to increase their healing and bias and speed up the formation of new muscle. And there are peptides, at least on the list of things that are up for approval, that do all of these things, which is probably why they're on the list that's up for approval, because there's consumer demand. And we'll get into the complicated bits of this, but these have been proposed to treat conditions including ulcerative colitis, obesity, insomnia, and injury. And there is, for some of them, rat or mouse data. There's not a lot of human data except one particular peptide that's been extensively studied in all the literatures from one lab in Croatia. And there's another lab in Russia that's been working on a different peptide. But a little bit of nuance here. This is an advisory committee. So these people review the research and listen to testimony from experts, and then they make a decision whether the FDA should, then they vote on each peptide to decide whether to recommend to the FDA to allow compounding pharmacies, which make specialized medicines, to produce the chemicals. We have two compounding pharmacies here in Santa Cruz. One of them is in Scotts Valley. It's called One Source, and the other is Loudon's, which is in Capitola. Neither of them paid me for their names. But just so you know, a compounding pharmacy is held to very strict standards of cleanliness, sterility. They have to they get inspected and drop-in inspections, like the health department going to a restaurant, real white glove inspections. And that's because a lot of the compounds they made are made to be injected. And I mean, it's one thing if you eat a pill that you've dropped on the floor. It's another if you use a needle that you've dropped on the floor to inject something into a vein. It's quite a different level. And even if you're injecting subcutaneously, which is how most of these are done, you're still putting yourself at a substantial risk. So one of the problems with peptides is that the big problem and the thing that's controversial is that the people who are on these committees are usually supposed to be people without conflicts of interest. And yet there are, I've read in one place 5 and another place 7 temporary members who've been appointed to this committee who have connections with the peptide industry and stand to make a lot of money if it's approved. If the FDA would allow compounding pharmacies to produce these, physicians would be able to prescribe them. People would also be able to purchase them through telehealth services, which have just gone through the roof, like mushrooms in January, because of the GLP-1 drugs. And so there's a lot of companies out there who have set up their infrastructure, and they've got their employed doctors whose job it is to make sure that, well, basically to make sure that it is safe to sell people these drugs. It's not to decide the people are going to this place having made the decision to purchase. This is just the gateway. And it's a due diligence thing, and I'm glad there's at least that much. But nevertheless, a lot of people are buying this stuff directly through a gray market. And proponents of the idea of letting compounding pharmacies do this are, at least they have standards, right? And we have lots of evidence that the current stuff that's being sold online through these gray markets is seriously, seriously substandard. For example, studies looking at the gray market products have found things like endotoxin, which is, yes, a toxin. They found toluene and other solvents. They found that the containers themselves are not sterile. So, and by the way, peptides are food if you're the right bacteria. So you could grow some really nasty stuff in there. Also, when you look at the amount that's listed on these gray market vials, the amount that's actually in there, if you go to the trouble and expense of doing a chromatography spectroscopy, what you find is that at best they contain about 28% of what it says on the label, and some of them have nothing. But in one study, they ranged from 4 to 28%. So the doses aren't even close to the doses that are being recommended by essentially people who are using them, and this is what I use. They don't know what they're using. They really don't. So I'll just run through these peptides quickly. There's one for ulcerative colitis. There's one that's supposed to help treat opiate withdrawal and insomnia. Another one that's supposed to help with insomnia. And that makes sense. A small molecule is going to get across the blood-brain barrier. And it's essentially these act like hormones. So they are, these are subsets of melatonin. So they're going to get into the brain and they're going to fit into the melatonin receptor, putatively at least. And that's going to help something. There's one for promoting wound healing and treating inflammation. Sounds good. There's one that's helps with insulin resistance and osteoporosis. There's one for migraines and also reported to help with trigeminal neuralgia, although I don't know, I don't think the data on that in humans is very good. And another used to promote wound healing, which also, of course, will help with muscle injury. And that's a little bit where the lobbying comes from. So let's suppose that this goes through and these are authorized. I've been thinking hard about it. And yes, the FDA released a draft agenda. This one says 8 temporary members who will vote on some or all of the peptides. I have a second article here that argues that the fix is in on the people who are on this committee and that they are almost a certain in to vote yes. If you come in as a yes vote, that's a fix. You want people who are actually do not have any self-interest and will look at not at, at making a decision based on the information that's available, the best information that's available, and not because it's going to affect the their business or the stock price of their business. But as I think about it, I'm actually kind of in favor of this happening just because that gives us a chance to register and track them. And now we have AI. So just imagine that we used our existing technology. And if you get one of these compounded peptides, you basically get a barcode or some sort of unique identifier number that identifies you and the drug. And this is, you know, password protected and all obscured and all of that. But essentially, if there's a bad batch that's really contaminated, or there's an adverse side effect, more importantly, because we are using compounding pharmacies, more importantly, if the ingredients are bad, and a lot of these peptides are coming in from China, and they're coming in large quantities, and they're going into the gray market, so we don't even know what we're getting, and our government is just they aren't going to illegalize the gray market. I think they're trying to compete with the gray market. And yeah, I think it's at least a strategy for us to gather data from those brave volunteers who are willing to take risks from themselves. And then when people are on these agents and they get a weird, a weird side effect, the fact that they're on the agent is known, the weird side effect is known, and we can start to gather some information. And, you know, we were talking just now in the previous show about privacy. And as my grandma used to say, on the matter of privacy, to a certain extent, the horse has left the barn. And we're not going to be able to claw back a lot of our personal information. So maybe we go a step forward and say, all right, well, this is personal information that I'm willing to sort of donate to the common, to the commonweal, in order that I should have access to this, to the good stuff at a fair price, and know that I'm actually getting what I'm paying for, in return for which we get to track you in case you get some, in case you grow a third eyeball, or in case you develop an unusual autoimmune disease and suddenly there's a cluster of that disease and we trace it back to a particular peptide and say, let's pull that one off the market. And it's not that far-fetched. There is a peptide that was released in another country. It was supposed to help you tan. So it was related to melanocortef, which the melanocortef receptor. So it was an analog for the receptor. And it was a nasal spray, so you didn't have to inject it. You just squirted it into your nose, which, by the way, could be a delivery pathway for a lot of peptides. But squirt it into your nose, and you'll get a tan. Well, what a few people got instead of a tan was they got nasal melanoma, which is vanishingly rare. Melanoma inside the nose, where the sun quite literally don't shine. And that's one that probably should never be released, and it is not on the list that's currently under consideration. But it is a cautionary example to say that these little molecules can have a big effect, and we need to go slowly and take notes. At least let's take notes, for goodness sakes, and figure out exactly if weird stuff stops happening, let's find it early. Remember thalidomide? That because of the way that was released in Europe, they had no idea that they were causing birth defects. And it went on for quite a while. They had a whole generation of children born, you know, with stubs, with their hands growing out of their shoulders. And what's the difference? Surveillance and tracking. And we're moving to a different topic. We're going to move to stories about cancer therapies that are emerging. And starting with a bizarre CRISPR enzyme that kills cancer cells by literally shredding their DNA. Now, let's talk about that. First of all, just to remind you what CRISPR is. CRISPR is a system that occurs naturally in bacteria and also in other microorganisms. Probably initially it evolved to protect against viruses. And in the case of CRISPR, the systems are hunter seekers. They use a string they use a short RNA string of 20 base pairs, or not base pairs, but bases, and they go around looking for the matching bases to form base pairs on a genome. When they find that on a genome, there's a little mechanism that swings around and cuts the DNA just behind that sequence. Now, you can build CRISPR systems like CRISPR-Cas9 that will actually drop other DNA in the system that will incorporate itself into the hole, essentially, that you've made in in that particular chromosome. And it works. They take it up and rebuild it and patch it and use that new code. And so we've been able to, for example, cure sickle cell anemia in people who were strongly affected by just one little base pair that's off, but it changes the way that the hemoglobin behaves in an acid environment, and it twists into a sort of crystalline shape and pokes holes in the red blood cells and creates spikes in the joints and is extremely painful. So go us that we can do that. And we're also using it for all kinds of genetic therapy. But there are more than one Cas systems. And so this is the story of Cas12a2. So about 10 years ago, a biochemist at Utah State University were trying to work with this Cas12a2, and they thought it would function like other Cas proteins for gene editing. But it was not working, and it kept not working. And they realized that after recognizing the RNA sequences that matched its guide RNA, it went wild and indiscriminately chewed up the DNA, causing the infective cell to stop growing. Basically, was acting as it was just killing off the virus or killing off the bacteria. And this way, of course, it could really halt not just the spread of the infection, but also fight the infection in a population. So the researchers subsequently said, well, could we use it to target cancer cells exclusively in living systems? Because cancer cells have different DNA that's activated. This DNA is stuff that is normally only used during the embryo's period of development. And if you reactivate it later, some of its properties, like being mobile and being able to move through various body tissues and through the cracks and effectively metastasize, exit blood vessels, stick to the sides of blood vessels, call blood vessels into existence to come and feed it. All of these things are uniquely important if you're an embryo, and a really bad idea if you're an adult. And so by targeting DNA that is unique to cancers, the researchers were able to show that they could destroy only the cancer cells that carried these sequences. So this is all still happening in tissue culture. And immediately one of the things I'm thinking about with this is, if this works, it could work way too well. And you'd have to be very careful about how you dosed it. But it could conceivably go after metastases that you don't even know you've got. And in doing that, you've removed the large amount of tumor, so you aren't going to get this massive toxic reaction when you kill off the tumor and you have this sort of dead mass of tissue in the middle of your body. Instead, you'd be basically eating the seed corn, the little bits of cancer cells that have broken off and are hiding in the lungs and hiding in the bone marrow and hiding in the brain. And that actually seems very promising, and I hope that it will, you know, we're going to move to animal studies soon, and that's where the toxicity issue starts to come in. So we've been using in cancer therapy for a long time, like 5 years, things called immune checkpoint inhibitors. And these are agents that counteract one of the effects that cancers have, which is to turn down T cell immunity. And T cells are the ones that are intended to go and kill the cancers. But if they're suppressed by a compound that's produced by the cancers and not produced by ordinary cells, except if they're supposed to be like the thymus, which is supposed to be controlling the immune system, it makes these compounds. But you know, if the thymus can make it, then any cell has the program to make it. Even the cancer cell has the program to make it. And if they start making it, lo and behold, oh, look, the immunity isn't as good against me. So, of course, that's the cancer cell that gets to survive and not be killed by the immune system. And so you can understand how something like this would evolve. So a drug that stops that, it's called an immune checkpoint inhibitor, is wonderful. The problem is the dosing. So when we give people immune checkpoint inhibitors, for example, they'll often get very inflamed. They'll get an inflammatory reaction, and because we've goosed their inflammatory cells. And in fact, it's the most common side effect is thyroiditis, and about, I think it may be as much as half, but it's at least a third of people who get this kind of chemotherapy for a cancer may have their cancer cured or put into remission, but they'll often trash all or part of their thyroid and have to be on thyroid medication as a result of the, well, collateral damage, I believe is the appropriate military term. All right, so that's our background. Now, people with cancer who are going to get these immune checkpoint inhibitors for their cancer, who coincidentally got COVID vaccines before they started their chemotherapy, which is would not be unusual, did significantly better in terms of the benefit of the drugs. And so their researchers have done some laboratory experiments, and again, law of unintended consequences, the vaccines rev up the immune system and make these stubborn tumors more susceptible to treatment. So this study was done as a retrospective. Obviously, no one has done a placebo trial where they take a cohort of people who are going to be getting the drug, and they give half of them the COVID vaccine and they don't give the other half and don't let the other half get the COVID vaccine, you can see why that might be a little problematic from a ethical standpoint. But nevertheless, there are a number of studies where they're looking at how long did the people live after, people who received a COVID-19 mRNA vaccine within 100 days of starting immunotherapy lived significantly longer. The median survival rate went from 20 months to 37, so that's almost doubling in advanced lung cancer. And people who received non-mRNA vaccines for influenza, pneumonia, etc., didn't have this chemotherapy advantage or this immunotherapy advantage. The mRNA vaccine acts like a siren. It triggers the release of immune signaling proteins, cytokines, including type 1 interferon. And this is the same protein responsible for many of the strong side effects people experience after getting immunized. So the lab data suggests, however, that this interferon activates immune cells inside the tumors and causes them to move into the lymph nodes, where they train other immune cells to travel back through the bloodstream and attack the tumors. This is a really interesting unintended consequence, and I just am very excited to see where this combo immunotherapy goes in the future and whether it doesn't necessarily, what if we develop other mRNA vaccines? Will they work just as well as the COVID vaccine? That needs to be established, but there's good reason to believe that this would work. So here's another revamped cancer immunotherapy that wiped out whole body tumor destruction. Essentially, there's a number of drugs that are a CD40 agonist antibody, and it hasn't worked. We'd love it to work. But researchers recently produced one that they injected directly into tumors. This is a small trial of 12 patients. But they injected into one tumor, and in several people, all of their tumors sank. And let's see, there were 12 people. Six saw all of their tumors shrink, not just the one that was injected. That's really interesting. And two experienced complete remission in this study. So this modified drug looked very, very powerful. So what is going on with CD40? It's a receptor on the surfaces of cells that belong to the tumor necrosis factor superfamily. And when it's activated, it basically signals the immune response to be stronger. The redesigned antibody basically binds to several receptors at once it binds to another antibody, so it creates like this cluster and literally stretches the skin on the surface of the cell, and this triggers changes in terms of what the translation of the DNA that's in there and acts as a stimulant for the production of this really aggressive immune response. One of the patients who was treated here had melanoma and dozens of tumors on her leg and foot. And after multiple injections of that one tumor, all the other tumors disappeared. And they had the same thing happen with a metastatic breast cancer that had tumors in her skin. All they did was inject the skin, but the tumors in her lungs and liver disappeared. So this is very, very intriguing and interesting and promising. All right. So winding up the show, we're going to switch to CAR T-cell, which is the cancer therapy that is working on blood cancers, and they're trying to get it to work on solid tumors. If they can make that work, it will be just amazing. I am a big fan of CAR T-cell therapy because it saved my husband's life from multiple myeloma, and I really am excited about this latest idea of building natural killer cells. They're not T cells, but analogous. So supercharged natural killer cells could become a way to reset autoimmune disease. There's two small clinical trials, and they're very promising. Researchers can engineer natural killer cells. These are immune cells that destroy infected or diseased cells. And they can be trained to assassinate and to target the renegade cells that produce antibodies against the body's own tissues. Autoantibodies, of course, damage tissues. They're intended to cause damage. That's their job. But they're supposed to be doing it on bacteria and on infections and not on yourself. So diseases like lupus, systemic sclerosis, these could, which are, you know, multiple sclerosis, these could all potentially be gone after in the same way that CAR T cell has proved so effective for multiple myeloma. So we have the natural killer cells can be taken from a blood donor. They don't have to come from the person themselves, which is great, and genetically modified to produce these CAR natural killer cells. These can then be frozen and used to treat multiple people. And the researcher, Dr. Rezvani, says that her colleagues at MD Anderson can make hundreds of doses of cells from a single donation of umbilical cord blood. Now, these cells are shorter lived than CAR T cell therapy. So this may not be a problem for autoimmune disease because a brief treatment could be enough to wipe out the autoantibody producing cells. Whereas it's not that the immune system is going to keep necessarily turning these out. The immune system could rebuild itself with a fresh population of antibody-producing cells that have not been triggered to make autoantibodies. It looks like this was tailor-made for autoimmune disease. And let's see, there's one study here, 27 people with systemic lupus, which can cause inflammation of the joints, kidneys, brain, all saw improvement. Some participants were followed for nearly 2 years after treatment and are still in remission. And the what they were targeting in this particular study was a single protein called CD19, which is on the surface of the cells that make the antibodies. So they also used another study. They did a single one. This was done in Shanghai on a person with systemic sclerosis, where your entire body starts to scar up, including your lining of your lungs, which of course will suffocate you eventually. The therapy seemed to restore normal skin and blood vessel structure in that individual, which is really interesting because this is a reversal of the damage done by the autoimmune disease. So that is what we say in science, an N of one, meaning that it worked once, and you don't know if it's going to work again. So you just say, wow, interesting, N of one, and I surely do hope it works again. Now here's a couple of real paradoxes, and this is related to prostate cancer and the therapy of androgen deprivation, where you're taking drugs to lower the amount of testosterone in the system. So we're going to start off with just saying that that is an established therapy for prostate cancer. But a paradox has recently come to light that in early disease, early prostate cancer, the tumor's not that big and hasn't spread that much, blocking testosterone halts tumor growth in early disease. But what's recently been discovered is that in advanced disease, actually giving large doses of testosterone seems to slow down the growth of the tumor. Researchers found that prostate cancer cells are hardwired with a system that allows them to proliferate when the levels of testosterone are very low. But when the hormone levels are elevated to resemble those present in a normal prostate, these cancer cells differentiate This is completely backwards. And so in advanced metastatic therapy, by doing hormone deprivation therapy, we may be doing the wrong thing, because the inhibition of androgen signaling causes the disease to progress to an even more aggressive form. What's going on? When the androgen levels are low, the androgen receptor is encouraged to go slow in the cell. So it activates the pathways that cause cancer cells to grow. So blocking that androgen by preventing it from being made will inhibit the growth of the cancer cells. Great. But as androgens rise, you basically eventually get a point where the cells flip. And now the absence of androgen actually becomes permissive for the growth of the cancer cells, because the cancer cells have changed their setting, if you will. And so in that setting, when you flood the tissues with androgens, the androgen receptors halts the tumor growth. So it's very, very paradoxical and intriguing. But let's talk a little bit more about modern therapy for this androgen deprivation therapy. And a bit of recent evidence suggesting that maybe there might be worsening of Parkinson's disease. And it's very contradictory and conflicting right now. And you'll find a bunch of studies, a big systemic review and meta-analysis found that androgen deprivation therapy was associated with an increased risk of Parkinson's, along with increased dementia, Alzheimer's, and depression. Okay, now that was a review and meta-analysis. So that's already a lot more likely to find a statistically significant risk because the numbers are so big. But also, it's not real science. It's a meta-analysis. It's basically, it's kind of fake science. It's not placebo. It's not comparable groups. And there are three studies, different kinds of studies. A cohort study, which means that you match person A and person B, and person A is getting androgen deprivation therapy and person B is not, and then you look at their Parkinson's disease risk, and that found no association. A large Canadian study, now not 2.5 million people. Remember, the larger the number, the more spurious statistical significance that's meaningless you get. This large Canadian study of almost 80,000 found no increase of Parkinson's with ADT, and they basically did some diddling with the numbers for competing risk of death, and so that maybe created a bias. A population-based study in Korea found no association. So we've got four studies, different methods, different results. But let's talk about the mechanistic considerations. Androgens can be neurotoxic under conditions of oxidative stress. So maybe that's why there are twice as many men as women who get Parkinson's disease. There was a mouse study that showed that if you castrated the mice, you got more Parkinson's disease. And then if you gave them testosterone, they got better. So that seems to be the opposite. And another study that found that androgens are neuroprotective, but exacerbate damage when oxidative stress is already elevated. Well, that sort of makes sense. So I wanted to just go a bit through the different kinds of drugs very briefly. So there is a type of drug that's called a gonadotropin-releasing hormone agonist, and there are second-generation receptor inhibitors that cross the blood-brain barrier. So in other words, these are doctored molecules that cross the blood-brain barrier and are used in prostate cancer. They're not focused there. They're trying to get to the rest of the body, but they do get into the brain. And there's one that's emerged as really high concern. So given that those studies were broad and they didn't break it out according to what drug was given, there's a drug that I just want to put out there. If you have prostate cancer and you're on the androgen deprivation therapy, stay away from enzalutamide, which is Xtandi. X-T-A-N-D-I is the trade name. E-N-Z-A-L-U-T-A-M-I-D-E is the drug. That one is probably the most concerning and probably the drug that has the least blood-brain penetration, so doesn't get into the brain, so literally can't cause Parkinson's disease, but does the same thing against prostate cancer, is called darolutamide, D-A-R-O-L-U-T-A-M-I-D-E. And that one seems to be the safest. So if you're on this therapy, check what you're on. Talk to your doctor. This is relatively new data. And I haven't seen anything that broke it down drug by drug before. And we've all been scratching our heads about these different results. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.